Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own stage left at Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Very, very well.
Did you read about what happened in Washington?
In Washington, D.C. You're talking about the robbery attempt?
Sort of.
Go ahead. Why don't we tell everybody? Yes, I read about it.
This was reported in the Washington Post. A grand feast of marinated steaks, jumbo shrimp was winding down, and a group of friends was sitting in the back patio of their Capitol Hill home, sipping red wine. Suddenly, a hooded man slid through an open gate and put the barrel of a handgun to the head of a 14-year-old guest.
Now, obviously, now you're being robbed at gunpoint. This is a very serious...
And they're pointing your gun at your kid.
At your 14-year-old. Very scary. Had to be just petrifying.
Give me your money. Give me your money or I'll start shooting, he says. The five other guests, including the girl's parents, froze. And then Christina, one of the guests, spoke. She said, "We're just finishing our dinner. Why don't you have a glass of wine with us?" Now, I don't know where the heck she got that. But God bless that woman.
Well, you know, she's probably just trying to calm him down and you know,
I know that it was smart,
the situation.
But it's one of those things that after somebody else does it, you say, "That's smart." What I say in that situation is,
"Here's my money."
No, just what I said. Nothing. I'm just... So the intruder took a sip of their wine, a Chateau Malascot Exuperé, and said, "Damn, that's good wine."
So now they're looking for an
enophile, yeah,
with a very good palate.
The girl's father described the interview. He said the intruder was in his 20s. He took the glass. Rowan offered him a bottle. I would, like, out in the house.
Take two, they're small.
He took another sip, and he took a bite of camembert, and then he takes the gun, puts it into his pocket, and says, "Yeah, I think I came to the wrong house. I'm sorry." And then he says, "Can I get a hug?"
Maybe he's having a bad day, you know? Sometimes when you're an armed gunman, you have a bad day, and you just need a hug.
So one of them hugged him, and then he asked for a group hug. And all five got around and hugged him.
Can I tell you something?
What?
If I had hugged him,
yeah,
he would have never come to from the hug. Okay, that would have been...
I'd have hugged him and gotten the gun.
It might not have been such a gentle hug.
So then he walks out with the crystal wine glass.
So without robbing them, okay? Now I think I've come to the wrong house. Thanks for the cheese. Thanks for the wine. He leaves with the wine glass.
The police are called. They're treating it as a robbery because, of course, you know, I don't care how nice you are, you can't point your gun at my 14-year-old's head.
Almost never.
yeah, that would bug me. And so they go out. The police go around looking. In the alley behind the house, they found the empty crystal wine glass unbroken.
Unbroken. So this is a guy who was ready to shoot someone in the head, but he gave him a glass of wine and a hug, and he decided not to.
On a related note, Cantor Magazine reports that bottle prices for Malascot Exuperé have gone through the roof as prisons across the country are purchasing the Bordeaux.
As a way to defuse the
yeah. All right, another slightly more disturbing note. We have a little
slightly
problem.
More disturbing, okay?
No, slightly. Well, it was a happy ending with that story. There's no
I
happy
guess
ending
so.
In China, they have a little problem with, food safety. The whole, you know, how we have the carts in New York that we push around or in mm-hmm. our cities, and they're inspected, and they have a little health inspection
thing.
Well,
they haven't been afraid to bring their food safety issues to the United States either.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But the ones they have at home are much worse. You ready for this?
Here's some. We've decided to put some poisonous rock in your dog food. Here you go.
They did shoot a guy for that.
Okay.
They did shoot a guy for that.
So you're saying they got mad at him for doing that?
Well, throughout China, in Beijing especially, there are a lot of little illegally run food stands, and the food quality, people take a lot of illegal shortcuts there. Mm-hmm. And
so the FDA is not watching the food stamps on the streets of Beijing?
But the state television's undercover investigation went after them. And they went after the producers of, I don't know how to pronounce it, I'm going to muddle it. It's B-A-O-Z-I. Bazi? Boise?
Okay.
Town in Idaho.
I'll let you sound stupid rather than try and pronounce it myself.
Well, it's a common snack in China that you buy on the street. It's got an outer skin made from wheat or rice flour and a filling of sliced pork.
It's like a big dumpling.
It's like a bun. It's like a bun. The hidden camera follows this guy who's selling them, and his face isn't shown, but they follow him into a ramshackle building where the steamers are filled with these fluffy white buns, traditionally stuffed with pork. The surroundings are filthy, okay, water, puddles, and the piles of old furniture and cardboard on the ground.
I don't think there's any huge surprise there.
Okay, what's the recipe? 6 to 4, the man asks. 60% cardboard, 40% fatty meat.
You know what?
Run that by you again. That's not the container. That's the dumpling.
And here's like just a thing for everybody that out there may not know. Cardboard isn't food. it's what we serve our food in or on sometimes, but it's never in our food.
Squares of cardboard picked from the ground are first soaked into a pulp in a plastic basin of caustic soda. We're not talking about Pepsi. The caustic soda is a chemical base commonly used in manufacturing paper and soap, then chopped into tiny morsels with a cleaver. I beg to differ with the author here on his choice of word for morsels
morsel.
Of
yes,
cardboard.
Exactly.
Morsels implies delectable, not cardboard. sawdust, maybe, or refuse. Fatty pork and powdered seasoning are then stirred into the soft cardboard. Soon, steaming servings of the buns appear, and the reporter takes a bite. Comment?
That's a very brave reporter, by the way. You got to give him kudos
but
there.
But you realize he
just watched them make this out of cardboard and caustic soda that was on the ground.
Yeah, but
okay?
But
in a slum of Beijing.
But you got to realize that he's probably eaten 1,000 of them through his life. I mean, they're on the street from the street vendor. The taste, it's filling, kind of tough, not much taste.
Tastes kind of like, what's the word I'm looking for? Cardboard. There it is. I've said that about grape nuts in the past. You think that's what they're doing?
The word we've got. Okay, so we have the killer.
But if you
robber.
Think about cardboard as, well, paper.
Yeah.
And you think about paper as, well,
wood.
A tree.
Yeah. Exactly.
Then, you know, maybe this is not such a... Oh, yeah, it's a big reach, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah, sorry. No, there's really no coming back from serving me cardboard in my food,
yeah,
ever,
yeah,
on purpose.
So, I don't know.
But it does reduce food costs, I'll tell you. You know, in our industry, so much of the time, you got to be looking at, you know, not wasting anything and food costs, and, you know, it is a business after all. So, what better, you know, to stretch your food than cardboard?
Food.
Food, okay. Food would actually be a better mixer in your food than cardboard.
Right. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Fritz Haig. Fritz is an architect and a social designer who initiated a project called Edible Estates. Edible Estates can turn front lawns into gardens, art, and produce.
Fritz, welcome to the show.
Great, thanks for having me.
I have for a long time looked at the front lawn of, you know, my parents' suburban house or any house that we lived in. And there's a lot of effort that went into that lawn. And what I've read about the typical suburban lawn as I've looked more and gotten more involved in agriculture, gotten more involved in trying to do what's right for the planet and maybe live sustainably and live well, grass actually eats up a lot of resources, not just people's obsessive time, but it takes a lot of petrochemicals to make grass. And is grass good or bad for a landscape?
Well, I think... There's obviously a lot of problems with it. I think it's really a matter of balance in our lives, like how we want to use the land that we've occupied. And I think, you know, there's definitely a case to be made for the occasional lawn which can be a real pleasure for kids. And, you know, it obviously serves certain real functions in our society, I think. But what I've chosen to look at in particular is the front lawn, which is, in most cases, completely impossible to defend all the resources that we devote to it and all the time we devote to it.
So why do we plant grass? Where does this come from? Why did we say, hey, you know what, grass would be great to put all over the lawns all over America?
Yeah, well, really, it goes back to English country estates when the owner of the English estate would demonstrate their vast wealth by showing that they could take otherwise valuable farmland and use it as nothing more than an ornamental landscape to present their huge house on.
Yeah, but here your vast wealth is a 12-by-12 plot in the front of your house, what's the point of that?
No, exactly. Well, the point is that this is a tradition that we are continuing 100 years later, and we continue it out of just sheer, I think for a lot of people it's just reflex. It's kind of the default surface that we assume anything we don't know what to do with will become, and we don't tend to think about it. So part of the Edible Estates Project is not just to advocate everyone growing food in their front yard, but also to remind people that they actually have a choice about how they can use their own private land. And I think when you break that pattern, people start to think about it.
I mean, I think a lot of us have used our backyards for gardens. I mean, my aunt has pretty much eliminated her backyard at her place and just created a giant garden, you know, herbiary, I guess.
But the Edible Estates Project will take someone's suburban home and take their front lawn and turn their front lawn into a garden. Why the front lawn?
Well, the whole point of the project is to turn food production into a public spectacle. So the production of food is not something that's relegated to the backyard because we view it as ugly or unseemly or not something that's meant to be seen by the neighbors, and turn it instead into something that we're really proud of, that not only do we do it in the front yard because it's space that hadn't been used that oftentimes has better solar exposure, for one thing, but also to get it on the street so that when the owners of the house are gardening, they're suddenly reconnected to their neighbors and their community in a way that they weren't previously either. And by the same time, conversely, the neighbors are being reminded of where their food comes from as they see it growing on this front lawn every day.
Do you know, you're reminding me exactly of a conversation we had with a guy named John Peterson, who was the subject of a documentary called The Real Truth About Farmer John. And he talks about his experiences growing up in the Midwest and watching agriculture there change over from the agriculture we had 30 years ago to the modern, or 40 years ago, to the modern sort of agribusiness agriculture we have today. And one of the things he said that was very striking is he said, you know, the land in the Midwest is largely depopulated. He said, when I was a kid and my father was farming that land, we would drive in the car and you would see people in the fields and you would wave to people on their tractor or people walking from here to there. And now when a huge agribusiness company owns, you know, a million acres, you'll drive for hours and not see anyone. And one of the things he talked about with his community-supported agriculture farm, about what this documentary is about, you can find out more about that on our website if you're interested, was that the absence of people is a very different sort of agriculture. And if you go by suburban homes, very often you'll find there aren't a lot of people in the front. But I guess if you're tending your garden in the front, wouldn't you stop by and go see what your neighbor was doing, maybe say hello, you know, whereas you're not going to do that in their backyard.
Maybe eat a strawberry.
Yeah. Well, I mean, is that part of the purpose of what you're doing?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's so interesting about our industrial food machine today, which, again, if I just go back to the English estates, has its roots there. When the owner of this English estate decided to hide their food production in a vegetable garden, it really set this precedent saying that plants that produce food are ugly and are meant to be separate from our daily lives. That is, where we grow our food couldn't be conceived of as a pleasure garden the way it had previously. In previous civilizations, the idea of a garden that produced food was like Eden. It was the center
of
everything, whereas today it's been relegated to, you know, vast tracts of land that nobody ever sees or...
or hidden in the backyard, even if you make it in the suburbs. And you know that, that's corollary to another change in manners that we've had, and maybe this is a logical extension. The Edible Estates Project is a logical extension of
that.
Are
you going to talk about the one where you don't say hello to your neighbors anymore? Is that the change in manners?
No, that's an unfortunate happenstance. But, you know, it used to be the way they designed Victorian houses was the kitchen was as far away from the dining room as possible. And modern people who buy Victorian houses often wonder at that, but that's because the smell of food cooking was thought to be rude. Like, the idea that you would have to work, that's supposed to be done by servants unseen and the food's supposed to arrive. It's sort of a similar ethos there. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back in just a moment talking more with Fritz Haig about his Edible Estates project and how maybe you can turn your front lawn into a vegetable garden. Sounds dramatic, but I like it. Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick. And its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Our guest is Fritz Haig. He is an expert in turning your front lawn, not your back lawn, into a vegetable garden. Revolutionary. We like him.
So, Fritz, you've begun this project in a lot of different places. Can you talk about why you've chosen to do this all over the world in different types of settings?
Yeah. Well, actually, I might start by saying I'm not really an expert at anything. You know, I'm just doing something that anyone could really do, I suppose, in some ways. I mean, my background is in architecture and art, and this started out as an art project that's sponsored by museums and art institutions. But it's not really important that most people even know that. That's just where it comes from, really. But, the first garden was planted kind of symbolically on Independence Day in the geographic center of the United States in Salina, Kansas. And it immediately became apparent after that first project that this should be a series of prototype gardens around the country so that each one could be very different response to its climate and its place, and people in that region would have some sort of model to look at of how they could do this for themselves.
And there's one of them right here in Maplewood, New Jersey, right?
That's right. Just finished that one maybe 2 months ago.
Now, you help the people set these model gardens up, and you solicit donations, and a lot of people come up to help these model gardens. Is this in the hopes that people will then look at this and say, you know what, I'm going to do this with my own land, with their own money going forward?
Well, I think that would be beautiful. I mean, yeah, it would be beautiful if everyone ripped up their front lawns and planted fruit in their front yard. I don't think that's going to happen, but the project is really using these kind of vehicles, mediums of gardens and food and front lawns and public space or private space to investigate some deeper truths about the world we live in today. And I think once you do this project, whatever happens is some sort of revelation of our society we live in today. If we don't have time or are not able to grow our own food, that says something about us. Whereas conversely, if this becomes a movement and something that captures people's attention and has a real impact, that says something too, and I'm prepared for it to go either way.
Can they use edibleestates.org, or can they use your organization, if people want to do this on their own, to help get information about how to do it?
Yeah, I mean, there's an extensive website that has a lot of links and statistics and information like that. But, you know, again, I'm not an organization. I'm just one independent person doing this by myself, really. And the gardens are individually sponsored by local institutions.
You're an individual with a damn great idea. We'll be back after the news talking more with Fritz Haig about turning front lawns into vegetable gardens. What a great idea. Central Jersey, 1450. It's 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Fritz Haig is an architect and an artist who initiated the Edible Estates Project. You can find out more about that at edibleestates.org or through our website at restaurantguysradio.org. He is going around the country in different regions and around the world, indeed, and changing the paradigm of the front lawn into a garden, and then looking at that as both a means of producing your own food, a different way of interacting with your community, and a piece of art. And I want to encourage anyone of our listeners who is considering doing this or does this to, because I know a bunch of you crazy people out there will embrace this, to give us an email and let us know if you're thinking about doing it, and we'll try and help you. I don't know that we can do very much, but we'll at least be able to document how things go on the Restaurant Guys Radio.
Fritz, one of the things, and I've read a lot about you in the recent past, and like I said, I know you did this project in Maplewood, and some friends at Dryer Farms, I know were part, one of the people who donated in Cranford, donated to your event. But one of the things that I think that I find with people who get in touch with picking their own food and growing their own food, and even when they go to one of these You Pick markets, they're much more concerned when they're actually seeing the food growing with what they put on the food and how they grow it and the types of fertilizer they use and the types of pesticides that they use. There seems to be a disconnect for a lot of people in this country with food that they buy in the grocery store as opposed to food that they pick themselves. Are you seeing more people reconnecting when they're growing their edible estate?
Yeah, that's definitely a part of the project. I think the one garden I just finished in the spring was in London, just in Southwark, just south of the Tate Modern, which sponsored it. And there, it was in a neighborhood where you would never see any food growing publicly in that way. And I think this is in London's versions of housing projects, council estates. And there are kids there, I'm sure, that had never really seen food growing before, which I suppose we could kind of take for granted. But yeah, I suppose kids living in the cities won't see food growing, but it's kind of crazy when you think about it, because their experience with food is so removed from the fact that it actually grows out of the dirt. And I think you're right. You know, when you have a daily or regular experience with eating directly from the land that's around you, you start to ask questions that you don't when your food is coming packaged.
Well, you just turn a blind eye towards it when it comes in a cellophane wrapper.
Well, what you say is, you know, it's funny, and I had a conversation. I recently, we're going to have a series of shows coming up from a visit that I did at Chin Vineyards, friends of our own organic, beyond organic vineyard, though it's not certified organic, in Long Island. And, you know, what David, who's one of the owners, said is, he said, you know, there's nothing I put on my plants or in my vineyards that I wouldn't feed to my dog. And you know that what that when you're growing your own produce and you buy a can of something that says, you know, be careful, don't let this touch your skin, or don't, you know, breathe in the fumes, or don't let this, and it's got a, you know, a skull and crossbones on it, and you start to put it on the plant from which you're going to pick a tomato, or on the soil next to the plant where you're going to pick a tomato, you start to think, wait a second. Well, I'm going to eat that.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas, you know, you say, oh, if you're in the supermarket, you say, oh, I don't need to buy from the organic section, you know. And it's an entirely different relationship with food. But one of the ways in which your project was successful, here in New Jersey, the Maplewood project was covered by the Star Ledger, and they wrote about the woman who lives in the home with her young son, and she said, you know, yes, there is a front yard to play in, but mostly they play in the backyard anyway. But I take my son out into the garden, and my son picks a grape at a year and a half old, or sees me pick a grape, or pick a cherry or something, and then eat it. And that's a whole different relationship that child will have with food. Mm. He knows that food comes from the ground. I thought this food came from cellophane packages.
And so will all the other kids in the street, too.
Yeah.
We planted the whole perimeter with a slope with strawberries, and the whole point being that anyone in the street can pick strawberries as they walk by. But the point of the project is that that experience becomes public. It becomes a public spectacle, so that the act of gardening becomes something that is, done for the neighbors,
Have there been any negative reactions in any of the projects you've done from any of the neighbors who said, a vegetable garden in the front lawn, that's ugly?
Yeah, I mean, there's always that. I think the project I'm doing is very constrained in particular. I'm focusing very strategically in very specific places and streets. So when I go to a, when I decided to do one in the New York area, I spent 6 months trying to find the right place and put out a call and got 20 applicants. But the whole point was to do it on a street where it would be provocative, where it would raise some eyebrows. And, of course, at first, it does because it's such a radical shift, but I'm quite sure that as people see it grow in and you see a family tending it for months, you tend to, just being a witness to that, you become empathetic to it. You can't watch a garden grow and not become somehow engaged with it. You can't, you can't stay angry for very long. I know the woman next door in Maplewood was quite upset when we planted it, and I'm interested to hear what her thoughts are now, like later in the summer.
Do the people who are planting these edible gardens in their front yard, do they know what they're in for? Do they know the amount of work that it takes to tend to these things?
Yeah, I make that very clear because it is, I think there's two interesting points about these gardens. One is that it's a lot of work. It's not easy, and it takes time. But the other one is that anybody can do it. You don't have to be an expert. Like, I really treat these gardens as laboratories where we just plant everything that's available and you see what works and you see what you like. And I think people need to open up to that possibility of experience as opposed to someone telling them how and what to do, which I've never been that interested in. And I think there's certain things, certain kind of information that needs to be handed down from generation to generation about how to grow food. But I think also it's just a firsthand experience that nothing can really take the place of that.
The other thing I think that's interesting is many people may not realize if you have a quarter acre or a half an acre of garden, you can get a lot of food out of that. You can really make a significant dent in feeding your family. So it's a lot of work, but it can, number one, it's going to get you better food.
Yeah.
Number two, it's going to reduce your grocery bill. And the other thing is, one of the things that we've really gotten into in the restaurant is the ancient art of canning or fermenting or putting fruits up in liquor. And so this is stuff that can feed you in the summer, but you can also either, of course, with modern technology, we can freeze things, and it can feed you largely through the winter. You can be having your own local stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the family in Lakewood, California, that's quite a small lot. The front lawn garden that we did is only 35 feet by 20 feet. They fed themselves for the entire summer and froze and fed their neighbors because they couldn't eat it all.
Wow,
that's just, you can grow an enormous amount of food in a very small space, and most people don't really realize that.
I'm going to tell you, a huge amount of the produce for my restaurant comes from a one-acre garden that we use. For one of the farms is a one-acre garden.
Now, you have volunteers come when you pick a project to do as a sort of a showcase project. How does that all work? Who comes and helps? How do you get them? Who's interested in doing this?
Well, let's see. The one in, and I do think it's important that it's volunteers and you don't hire people to do this, but it's friends and people that are connected in some way with the project. In New York, I used to live there, so a lot of my friends came out from Manhattan. But in London, it was the Tate Modern, so it was higher profile, and I have a lot of friends there, too. But also, we really worked with this local organization called Bankside Open Spaces Trust, and we got all the residents in the building kind of involved, and, a lot of people always turn out.
Once you create something that's alive and it continues to grow, if you've brought a community together to help have a vested interest in putting it together, it becomes something that is really a part of the community. And I think this is a tremendous community builder. What's the longest project you've had? What's the first project you did? And how's it doing today? And what's been the effect on the community there?
Well, I mean, it hasn't been that long. I only started this project 2 years ago, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, and all four gardens are still going, and I have one I'm starting in Austin, Texas, in the next spring. But, it hasn't been that long, so we'll see. I'm really interested to follow them. Even in the very short time that the one in London has been there, which has been like 3 months, it's had this amazing effect where at first there was very little interest in the buildings, frankly. It was only two adults out of the Teach building that actually took a vested interest in, but all the children, all the kids were on board right away.
Uh-huh.
But now there's a photographer that visits every week, and I have reports back, and it sounds like everyone's slowly coming out of the woodwork in this neighborhood and starting to take care of the garden and eat from it, and they're meeting everybody in a way that they hadn't previously, and it's very sad.
I'm sure they could become very protective over it as well.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see, because it's not a conventional community garden, that one. It's not a front lawn, and it's not a community garden. It's something in between. It's a public edible garden that people... The idea was whoever tends it can eat from it.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you, Fritz, it's really, you've taken a basic assumption and really made us look at it, and maybe we'll come up with a new paradigm. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Fritz Haig about his project, The Edible Estates, turning your front lawn into a vegetable garden. Central Jersey, 1450, the time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful emotional and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on Nine is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on Nine supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on Nine has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on Nine, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightsonnine.com. That's lightsonthenumber9.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Fritz Haig, who is an architect and an artist, and his project is called The Edible Estates, where he will turn your front, or he will help you to turn your front lawn into a vegetable garden.
So, Fritz, you have an architectural background and an artist background. Is this more from, does this spawn from your architectural background, your artistic background, or are you trying to make more of a political statement? What is it of those?
It's all of those things. I mean, depending on who's talking about the project, it's discussed in different ways, and I quite like that. If I'm talking to a gardener, it's a gardening project, and it doesn't have to be about more than that necessarily. Or if I'm talking to an artist, we can talk about the history of a certain art tradition that this might be a part of, and that's fine too. But I'm mostly interested in doing a project that really engages with the realities of how we live today, A lot of the project grew out of kind of a frustration with how architecture, art, design, these communities are so insular, and I really wanted to extend out of that. But and also just coming from an architectural background, really thinking about how we occupy space and how we relate to each other in the cities and the buildings that we've made for ourselves. Not specifically thinking about new buildings or monuments to be built, but how do we deal with what we've already have, the land we've already occupied, and how can we occupy it in a more thoughtful way.
Think about a suburban street, an average suburban street, maybe a little sterile. Where my parents live, there are no sidewalks, okay? Now, I think about that block where, you know, the houses are basically one of three models painted a different color and put in a different position on the lot. And I think about what that neighborhood would look like if every fifth house had a vegetable garden in front of it. It would bring the community to life. And, you know, the thing about a garden is the houses may all be the same, but you can even try and plant similar gardens and similar stuff, but every garden is a unique living thing.
Sure, your sunlight will be different.
And a unique living thing with people in it.
Yeah. And, you know, the other interesting thing about that is, and the important thing about the project is that it is private land, and independent people can decide on their own to do this. It's not a political decision. It's not at the mercy of some large corporation. If individually private homeowners together decide to do this, we could change the whole face of our country very quickly. These kind of small, modest moves individually.
Well, speaking about at the mercy of, I mean, people like me. I mean, I've basically given up even gardening in my backyard because of rabbits and deer and squirrel and those types of things. How do you deal with those types of things when, you know, your property's not fenced in, it doesn't have a groundhog fence? What do you do in those types of situations?
Yeah, well, I guess I've been fortunate that the first four gardens haven't had those problems yet. None of them had those kind of predators. And I originally put up a rabbit fence in Salina, Kansas, but they didn't even need that. I know. I mean, in my garden in L.A., it's a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things that invade regularly. But I don't know. It's really a case-by-case basis. You know, with neighborhoods with deer, I don't know what they do. Maybe you fence in the whole neighborhood.
That's an ecological disaster, but we won't do that. But, you know, the other thing is, if you think about it, though, your backyard is abandoned most of the day. No one walks through your backyard. And if you have deer wander into your backyard or vermin working on different kind of pests, we won't call them vermin, different kind of pests working on your stuff in your back, that's very different than, I mean, that's a deer with cojones to walk up into your front lawn,
right.
You know, and you have neighbors to shoo the deer away. I mean, I'm not conjecturing that is it what would happen, but it changes the whole paradigm. I wonder how it could change, and maybe positively. Maybe it's harder for pests to bother a garden in front of a house.
Maybe I hadn't really thought about that, actually, but...
You know, we basically you can always sit on your front porch with a .22. No, well, you probably can't do that in the
suburbs.
And a dog. A dog's a good idea. Hey, Fritz, I have to say, the work you're doing is amazing. It's a great idea, and I hope it spreads virally throughout the country.
Thanks so much.
Now, you have a website that people can go to find out more about what it is that you're doing and see some pictures and the like?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I'm holding in my hands right now the mock-up for the Edible Estates book, which I just got today, and that comes out in March.
Now,
and the website's edibleestates.org.
So it's edibleestates.org, not edibleestates.com. We'll put the link up on our website. And listen, if anybody out there decides to do this, please email us and let us know you're thinking about it. And if you do it, I want to see pictures. I want to see it. And we'll send them on to Fritz.
That's great.
So, Fritz, where's your next project?
The next one's in Austin, Texas. I'll be planting that in March.
Is it a suburban home? What is the deal there?
I haven't selected the house yet, but I really want to do it with a condo or like an apartment building where people don't have, you know, their own kind of yard, let's say, and to claim some unused land around a condo apartment building.
Cool. So if you're out in Austin, Texas, listening to the podcast or in that area, you live in a condo or an apartment, make sure you contact us, and we'll make sure Fritz gets the message.
That'd be great.
All right, so you want to email that to mark@restaurantguysradio.com, and he'll forward your application on to Fritz if you're out in Austin. Thanks so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk with us. It's been a great, great hour.
Thank you.
Thanks, Fritz.
Thanks.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis.
Francis, a little while ago we were talking with Fritz Hagen. One of the things that he talked about was biodiversity. And one of the things that these edible front yards have are biodiversity. I know you recently spent some time out with Barbara Shin at Shin Vineyards, and we talked about that briefly. And we're going to have her on the show to talk about her vineyard. But one of the things she talks about is biodiversity and how that's good for your crops. That's good for your land. That will help things to grow, and they naturally need to grow that way. And what we try and do with this monoculture of grass in our front lawn is a very unnatural thing, and that's why we have to use so many pesticides.
And remember that what the English the tradition of the English manor house was to purposefully waste that land by having just a pretty lawn. Now, what does grass do? Now, grass has some positive things. Now, you can also grow turf, and if you select the right kind of turf, you may only have to water it five times a year. Mm-hmm. You may not have to use so many pesticides, and if you have the right sunshine. But one of the things that grass does is grass keeps the air immediately above it 20 degrees cooler than dirt and 40 degrees cooler than concrete. So it has a cooling effect. But you know what? So does a garden. It's the plant life and the photosynthesis that's going on that has a cooling effect. And some of those tall plants in the garden can create rows for you to bring your kids in or to you to walk around and just... Me just going to the green markets, I have greater appreciation for the passage of time, for the passage of summer, and I eat my way through, I mark my way through the seasons with the passage of time, as I know you do. Having that garden and having it be right there in your front lawn that you walk through, And that's a great thing. And that's a great statement that you show other people, but it's a great way for you to live and actually use your front yard and be in it.
But let's not sugarcoat this, okay? This is a difficult thing to do. To have a real garden that's active and working and growing things is perpetual.
So what? So it's a lot of hard work if you want to get out there and do it yourself. But if you're rich, just pay somebody. Just pay somebody. I know we have a lot of rich listeners. Just do that. But it will still be a nice way to make a statement with your front lawn. I hope you've enjoyed this hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. It's 12 noon.